Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. For the past few years, the Alberta Research Council has been working in Paraguay to help the people there develop sustainable forest management practices. But what these scientists have learned is there's more to saving the forest than saving the trees. It's people issues that come first. This story coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Saving a rainforest in South America may seem a bit off the beaten track for the scientists at the Alberta Research Council, but when some concerned citizens of Paraguay wanted help in saving a very important forest reserve in their country, it was the ARC they came to for help. The project is a collaboration between the Moses Bertoni Foundation of Paraguay, CETA, the Canadian International Development Agency, and the Alberta Research Council. Ross Mitchell is the project manager.
Well, the objective of the project is sustainable land use planning, and that would be the major component, but a second and almost equally important component is making sure that it's participatory as much as possible. So we're creating a management committee that can do sustainable land use planning, and the two of them combined, I think, you know, you can't have one without the other in the region of Paraguay that we're operating in.
Now, going from Alberta to Paraguay and the area of concern, how does that differ from what our forests are like here?
Well, we're working in Paraguay in the Atlantic rainforest, and so that there's a tropical aspect to the forest there that you won't see here. For example, ferns and palms and citric fruits even that grow in the forest. The biodiversity is probably a lot richer than you'd find in Alberta. There's plants that are still being found that have never been heard of before. And so that's one thing. The humidity and heat in the forest there is something to contend with, especially starting around this time of year to around April. It's very much like walking through a sauna, I found, my first time I walked through a Paraguayan forest. And conifers you won't find, to my understanding, in the Paraguayan Atlantic rainforest.
What is the threat to that area?
The biggest threat is deforestation. And what's causing deforestation is mostly agriculture, both large-scale and small-scale agriculture. So illegal logging is part of that. Sometimes the wood is being sold and profit is being made from the logs. Certain trees are more valuable than others. But often it's just cut down and burned, and land is cleared to make way for either ranching or often soybean.
How is it that you're working with the Paraguayan people?
We started working with them in 2004 on this project with CETA. And so it started in April of that year. And initially, our first work involved with the project meant going up to the field, which was a long trip in those days. The road wasn't paved. And during a rainy season, it would often take us 10 or 12 hours to get to the area in northeastern Paraguay. And then we would start meeting. We started meeting with local folk. There's five municipalities in the project area, so getting to know the municipal council and the mayors, also meeting with the indigenous leaders. There's several indigenous groups, women's cooperatives as well, youth leaders, and we met a lot with campesinos, small fall farmers or landowners, as well as the large landowners. The last group was the hardest to meet with because often they weren't there. A lot of the landowners come from Brazil, and they may not actually live on the land that they're working on. So, but we tried to meet as much as possible with them to find out what their concerns were originally and what they felt about the kind of objectives we had with the project, if they felt that what we were going to do or intended to do made sense for them.
What would you say have been the hardest obstacles to overcome?
I think communication has been an obstacle with the project in terms of, you know, managing this a project of this nature and this complexity from Alberta was a bit difficult. It meant in the first year that we sat down and reevaluated our commitment to it. And rather than just having more frequent phone calls and emails, that we would have to actually go down and spend more time with our partners and also talk about bringing them up to meet with us here. So it just meant more face-to-face interaction, and that was an obstacle at first. And once we started doing more of that, having more open conversation about what the issues were and how we were going to achieve the objectives. Face-to-face, it started making a big difference. Another big challenge was logistics. We didn't even have a truck, for example. So we negotiated and worked out an arrangement, a financial arrangement, where we could actually have a truck and maybe a motorcycle. And in fact, a motorcycle is probably the best way to get around. But without a vehicle, you know, you can't really work in the region we're working in. The distances, not that they're long, it's just that the roads are very poor and it takes a long time to get from one community to the other. So logistically, it meant we had to get some sort of vehicle. And so we spent the first year often without one, and that made things a little bit more challenging. The last 2 years, we've had a truck and a motorcycle, and it's made our work a lot easier.
You're working in an area where it sounds like it's fairly remote and rustic. You have a hard time even getting transportation, and yet at the same time, you're trying to involve up-to-date technology in dealing with the forest sustainability issues down there. And I understand that you're using the ALCES program, which was developed by an Alberta scientist, Brad Stelfox. What role is ALCES playing in this?
We thought we would introduce ALCES for this project for one reason in particular. It's an interesting tool to discuss the outcomes of the tool around the table with. It basically is a decision-making tool. It's not so much a spatially explicit tool, and Brad is the first to admit that it isn't. But what it does allow us is it produces some scenarios that are plausible. Maybe not real, maybe they're never going to happen the way they're portrayed in the model, but they have some basis in reality in the assumptions that we put into the model. And if we agree that those assumptions are probably pretty good, then we can discuss the outcomes of those scenarios for the future around the table. And that doesn't require being an expert. So we want to make sure that we were choosing a model that wasn't just good for technicians or engineers, but also for anybody. And so that included politicians, that included poor people that live in the area, large landowners, indigenous groups, NGO workers, anybody and everybody that works or is associated with that area. We wanted them to be able to sit around the table and discuss what was meaningful for them in terms of the outcome of the model. And if we could play around with, well, one variable and see what the people felt about that change in terms of what would happen to the forest over time, or agriculture or any other sector we're interested in, and then have people discuss those options. I think that was what we were shooting for. And ALCES allowed us the option of doing that. So we could actually bring it into a room or a space and discuss the model in a way that was non-technical.
How have people reacted to that?
Well, we tested the model, at least an earlier version of it, in March. We did about 12 workshops in the field this past March in Paraguay. And we found that, actually somewhat surprisingly, that people were understanding it. And we adjusted the model and the talk, of course, for different groups. But some of our most animated discussions were with the poorest people who were really interested in discussing sustainable options for the future. And we're much more up on what I thought their understanding of sustainability would be than So we took for granted that they might not have that much of an interest in the area of sustainable development. And it turns out we were wrong. They were very interested in it because it affects their livelihood and their families, their communities. And a lot of them have an excellent understanding of what is probably good for the environment and what is not so good. And they were able to talk about it in a sophisticated fashion. So we are very impressed with that.
Thank you very much, Ross.
You're welcome. Thanks, Cheryl. Nice talking to you.
That was Ross Mitchell, manager of the Alberta Research Council's Paraguay project. Jens Baranza is the secretary director of the Moses Bertoni Foundation in Paraguay. He recently visited Alberta for some technical training on the ALCES program for land use planning. This will help the people in Paraguay as they develop their plans to both preserve their forest while improving their social and economic situation at the same time.
Yes, I mean, this project focuses on land use planning. And just to explain to you, we are managing a very important forest reserve in Paraguay, which is the last remaining portion of the Atlantic forest, which has been deforested in a rate of 7 million hectares in the last 40 years. So this is the last remaining portion of land in the Atlantic forest region ecosystem. We are managing 65,000 hectares. But now we are not talking only about that reserve, but about the biosphere reserve. The biosphere reserve is a concept. It's a declaration by UNESCO we obtained in 2000, yes, 4, 5, or 6 years ago. And that means we shifted from a focus on our reserve to a focus on the biosphere reserve, trying to develop the region. I mean, trying to help the development, the sustainable development of the region. And then we have to work in a high diversity of actors, with small land owners, large land owners, politicians, indigenous communities, urban communities, rural communities, so an NGO like us. So we are trying to develop, or we are trying to promote a model of sustainable development for the region. And when we start talking about that, we also need to focus in other things than only conservation. I mean, that only taking care of our reserve. We have to talk about community development. We have to talk about land use planning. We have to talk about education. We have to talk about creating wealth, I mean, for the community. And in this kind of focus, this project with ARC, focusing on land use planning, is very important for us, because probably it's the first time that we really start to work with the community. I mean, we can't just be the expert that can go to a community and say, okay, this is the land plan use for the future. This is the way you have to behave in order to conserve or in order to develop your region. I mean, we can say that. We have to go and build that with the community in a participatory methods in order to get the commitment from the community. So we are really happy because this project is so focused in build this management committee. So they are the one who have to do this land use planning for the future.
What kind of land use planning are you trying to put in place?
They have to decide that. I mean, they are the one who have to decide. Do they prefer to have, the whole area deforested, and probably that will mean more soybean producer, but that also will mean the loss of wildlife. That can also mean worse quality, water quality. I mean, all the decisions you made have some implication. So what we can to do with those kind of tools, like also, for instance, which is a tool for presenting different scenarios, and with that process, it's just share with them the whole range of possibility of alternative. But they are the ones, like a community, who have to decide what they want for their future, what kind of development they want.
What is it that people are saying to you so far?
That's a very good question, because they really are concerned about what is happening with, for instance, with the environmental situation in the region, but they are also concerned about education. For me, this is a very poverty region, so they also need more jobs. They also need to improve their incomes, and you know the great question is, how can we find an equilibrium between those all things? And there are some alternatives, and they are starting to understand and to see where are those alternatives. So we're really happy that is happening, and our role will be to help them with this kind of tool so they can have all the tools in order to make better decisions.
So it's more than just going in there and saving the trees. It's something much bigger.
It's absolutely something much bigger. I mean, we can't stay just, because we manage the reserve. We also have some guard parks taking care of the reserve. We are having around 18 guard parks taking care of the reserve. But this is not enough. I mean, the only way to take care about the environment at the end is promoting a new model of development. That's the only way. That we call sustainable development. And we want to work in a triple bottom line. I mean, we want to create economic value, we want to create also social value and environmental value as well. And we have to do that at the same time. So that is our challenge. And that is shared with the community. The community is sharing with us that goal, that challenge.
Now, when you look at the political situation in Paraguay over the last few years, mm-hmm. you've gone essentially from a dictatorship to now going towards a more democratic means of doing things. How do you bring about this change in consciousness so that people become more attuned to, I guess, consensus building on what to do mm-hmm. about their development and their forests?
Well, in fact, our dictatorship ended 15 years ago. But anyway, most of the structure, the mental structure between the between those communities are very related to an authoritarian way of life. So that is true. So it's not easy to deal with that. Another thing is that there is, and probably because of 35 years of dictatorship, there is a lack of culture of participation. And it's not easy to get involved with people. But anyway, when you help to create better conditions to people to participate, they want to do it. Finally, they want to do it. They want to express themselves. And we are trying to do that. Just creating better conditions in order to them to participate. But this is a process. It's not very fast. We have to have some patience. It's not always, we can't have always all the answers. And we really have to respect this process. Because after many, many years of lack of participation, of dictatorship, things are really different. So we really have to respect the process.
In Alberta, when conservation and trying to do what was right for the forests and for the environment, when that was of top concern for the people, the thing that really helped move it forward was the science and the research that mm-hmm. said we really have to make a change. How is that being used in your country, in Paraguay? How do the people respond to science?
It depends. One more time. If you just go to a community with your research made by, some researcher from a very well-known university from Canada or from the United States, it doesn't, the question is, does that mean anything, something important for them? Because if it's only a research without meaning from them, nothing will happen. Nothing will change. You will have a document, you will have the research, but nothing else. anyway, it's important, this kind of document. It's important, those research, in order to show the people what could happen. But what is really important is how you are doing that. What is the process in order them to understand what is happening? What is the language you are talking to them? So the science is, of course, is absolutely important, but it's even more important how can they really understand that from their own conscience, from their own understanding. So we have to be very, very careful, and we have to be able to translate what the science says to them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Jaron.
That was Jens Perenza, Secretary Director of the Moses Bertoni Foundation in Paraguay. Scientists from the Alberta Research Council realized very early when they started to work with the Paraguayan people that saving the forest there depended very much on addressing the underlying social issues. Loreen Elgard is a research scientist at the ARC. She's been involved with helping the different groups in Paraguay establish a committee to deal with these concerns.
Well, I think in the very beginning of the project, we were very ecologically focused. And so we were thinking about ecological processes, about, we were focused quite strongly on the environmental and ecological side of things. However, since since then, since the beginning of the project, we've realized that one of the biggest barriers to environmental sustainability come in the form of social issues, economic issues such as poverty, such as lack of education, and lack of awareness. And so we realized that in order to make any sort of environmental impact in the area, we would have to focus more strongly on the social and political processes involved with decision making and enforcement of land use planning.
Give me an example, then, of some of the social issues that you're dealing with. You mentioned poverty.
Well, poverty is certainly an issue. The biosphere, not with all the stakeholders, certainly, the Biosphere Reserve is home to a huge human diversity. So there are a handful of very rich, large landowners. And then beyond that, there are also very many small landowners that to varying degrees experience poverty in terms of lack of access to resources, also lack of access to services, government-provided health care, education. Another real issue in the area is isolation, geographical, physical isolation. Very little infrastructure, so the roads are dirt. They're not cared for. They're not tended to. Furthermore, there's no transport. This also becomes an issue with transporting produce. Most of the small campesinos are agricultural people, and they produce some cash crops. But once the cash crops are harvested, getting them to market is virtually they're very highly dependent on outsiders to come in and get them because there's no transportation.
How does that impact, though, on the trees or the forest?
Well, the fear is that once people are pushed to the margins of their livelihoods, once they're pushed to the margins of economic sustainability, they will likely be forced or be encouraged to enter into the reserve, the protected area, in order to exploit the resources within the reserve. And so it's believed that if we can help raise incomes, improve livelihood securities in communities surrounding the protected area, the reserve, which forms the nucleus of the Biosphere Reserve, then people will be less likely to feel the need or desire to invade the protected area.
The project now is at least 5 years old. What's been accomplished so far?
What we have achieved is, to date, several things. The first thing is the creation of the Biosphere Reserve Committee in an area where there is very little trust. I mean, up until very recently, fewer than 20 years ago, Paraguay was a dictatorship, and it was a very powerful dictatorship and a very oppressive dictatorship. And so people have learned to be very wary of each other. There's not a lot of social capital or trust between people. And with the diversity of stakeholders, the whole social situation in the Biosphere Reserve seemed to us to be very difficult to deal with in terms of trying to organize a group of different stakeholders that would come together to make decisions. And so, despite the challenges that lie ahead, we have formed a Biosphere Reserve Committee, and they are actually accomplishing things. They're doing things. They're making plans together, and they're accomplishing things. For example, quite recently, the Biosphere Reserve Committee arranged for a workshop on environmental legislation, and they delivered this workshop to political candidates in the area, in the Biosphere Reserve. All the political candidates came to the workshop and learned about environmental legislation. And this was something that was spearheaded by the Biosphere Reserve Committee, which is quite an achievement if you think the Biosphere Reserve Committee is composed of such different backgrounds and such different interests that they came together to arrange this. Is quite an impressive feat.
So is it a sense of empowering the people who are there?
Well, very much so, very much so. And, ultimately that's the idea, is to provide support to a Biosphere Reserve Committee in such a way that they feel that change is not only desirable but possible. And I think with our support and with the support of the NGOs that are working in the Biosphere Reserve, and hopefully with the further support they receive in the future, hopefully that that's exactly what will happen, because they'll feel that, that change is possible.
One of the concerns, though, is that this is a country where people have gone from a dictatorship, and now it's the opposite. They're trying to be democratic about things. What guarantees do you have that the government is going to buy into it and stay in it?
Well, this question, it's a good question, and it reflects many of the challenges we've experienced in the project up until now. In the beginning, it was very hard to interest, to create any kind of interest or motivation or synergy within the government departments, because I think that our project was very much viewed as just another project, and people had very little interest. But over the last 2.5 years, I think we've been able to overcome some of that apathy or indifference in the government by creating a situation in which the government is somewhat pressured by local groups that have been recruited into the Biosphere Reserve Committee and have an interest and a vested interest in the well-being of the area, both ecologically speaking and socially speaking, and economically speaking. And this has created a bit of a groundswell in which the government is feeling pressure to get involved. And at this point, we have been fortunate to have been able to create some of this interest. And at the present time, we actually have pending an agreement with the SEAM, the Secretaria de Medio Ambiente, the Secretary of Environment, whereby they will officially recognize the Biosphere Reserve Committee to one extent or another, which is kind of left undetermined up until now, but under which they will recognize the Biosphere Reserve Committee as an official body with decision-making powers. And so this has been a huge success.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Loreen Elgert, a research scientist with the Alberta Research Council. She's involved in the Paraguay project. I also spoke with the ARC's Ross Mitchell and Jan Speranzo of the Moses Bertoni Foundation in Paraguay. The rainforest at the center of their project is now a UNESCO Man and Biosphere Site. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Research Council, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Alberta Conservation Association, the University of Lethbridge, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Calgary Technologies, Inc., Alberta Innovation and Science, Alberta Gaming Research Institute, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Alberta Ingenuity, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, and the NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.